This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I know, you're frustrated. Last week, the economic numbers were better than expected and everybody was happy. Now the numbers are quite the opposite and you don't know what to think. So we'll try to help you out. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Thursday. It's the 24th of July today, and you can forget about all that better than expected stuff. Let me just tick off a couple of today's particulars. There's the $9 billion Ford loss last quarter, worse than expected. We'll get to it in a minute. The weekly report on unemployment claims hit levels not seen since Hurricane Katrina, also worse than expected. And let's not forget the housing market. The National Association of Realtors reported today existing home sales fell more than 2.5% last month. That's more than twice as bad as analysts were expecting. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains how they got that so wrong.
Nobody expected the housing market to suddenly bounce back, but the size of June's decline in home sales caught Celia Chen off guard. She's director of housing economics at MoodysEconomy.com.
I thought that the numbers would be slightly higher than they came in, predominantly because we've been seeing a lot of foreclosure home sales, and I thought that that would push up the numbers a bit.
Home sales did increase in some places hard hit by foreclosures, cities like Fort Myers, Florida, Sacramento, and Las Vegas. Lawrence Yoon is chief economist with the National Association of Realtors. He says the trouble is sales fell in places you might not expect.
Houston, Dallas, Kansas City, Atlanta, these are affordable markets. These are the markets with strong local job market conditions. We are seeing a droppage in home sales activity.
Yoon says that's because many would-be buyers are waiting on the sidelines to see if prices come down even more. He says tighter lending standards mean some people can't get loans. Christopher Thornburg with Beacon Economics says factor in the softening job market nationwide, and the sales declines are no surprise.
Add it up. Weak economy, weak financial system, and a housing market that still has some ways to go till it resembles something stable. And there's no reason in the world to expect any kind of recovery in the housing market right now.
Thornburg says the new housing bill could keep things from getting worse. It includes a $7,500 tax credit for first-time buyers. The Realtor Association's Lawrence Yoon says that may be enough to push some of those fence sitters into the market. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
As soon as I heard the Ford news today, I thought back to an interview I did with CEO Alan Mulally about 6 months ago. We'd been talking about how he'd been trying to turn the company around and why it was taking so long.
We are a little bit behind where we maybe could have been, staying in the big trucks and SUVs a little bit too long, maybe not appreciating as well as we could that the fuel prices were going to stay up, that the consumer was going to continue to move towards smaller cars and utility vehicles.
So that was 6 months ago. This morning, Mulally found himself on a conference call with Wall Street analysts telling them he's found the answer, as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Ford will start building 6 new small car models in the U.S. by 2012, models that Ford now sells profitably overseas. And it's writing off $8 billion worth of inventory, mainly unsold trucks and SUVs. Their value falls in inverse relationship with gas prices. Gone are the company's projections of a turnaround by 2009.
But 2010, I think, convergence of factors which will push these companies back into the black.
That's Burnham Securities analyst David Healy. 2010 is when union agreements reached last year kick in. Those include concessions that will ease the pension and health care burdens on U.S. car companies. But Global Insight auto director Rebecca Lindland warns Ford shouldn't overreact to the downturn.
We don't want to see this sudden turn away from all SUVs because consumers aren't necessarily really making that commitment. We're in a little bit of a knee-jerk panic reaction right now.
Lindland says SUV and pickup truck sales will return, especially once the construction business recovers. She says Americans only began abandoning big vehicles when gasoline hit $4 a gallon.
Everyone sort of bought in to the perception that the U.S. wanted trucks, which was very true right up until about 90 days ago.
Even Asian carmakers were caught off guard by changing U.S. demand, says Lindland. Otherwise, she says, Toyota's new factory churning out big Tundra pickup trucks would be producing Prius hybrids instead. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
So Ford's kind of betting energy prices are going to stay high for a while, right? There's a company out there that's been making that bet for more than a decade now and making money doing it, too. We asked Marketplace's Dan Gretsch whether Southwest Airlines is going to be able to continue its winning streak.
This morning, Southwest announced its 69th straight profitable quarter. It's the only big U.S. carrier that's made any money in 2008. The secret to its success? More than any other airline, Southwest locked in the price of jet fuel when it was cheap, a strategy called hedging. Jet fuel today goes for nearly $4 a gallon. Southwest says with hedging contracts, it pays $1.50 less. In 10 years, hedging has saved Southwest $3.5 billion. That's equal to about 83% of the company's profits.
They were lucky. Nobody can call the future that well, that consistently, and be correct.
That's airline consultant Daryl Jenkins. He says hedging can be risky business. It requires cash up front, and price changes can trigger a demand for more funds.
Going into next year and the year after that, the hedging is going to become even more risky. Because right now, none of us have any idea where the price of jet fuel is going to be.
That uncertainty has led Southwest to slow its bets. The company hasn't bought a sizable hedging contract in 15 months. David Carter is a finance professor at Oklahoma State.
Prices being as high as they are, Southwest may want to ride the prices down rather than be committed to purchasing jet fuel at the current prices.
Most of Southwest's hedges lock in fuel at $51 a barrel. They're set to expire gradually by 2012. To make up for shrinking hedges, Southwest plans to expand in cities like Denver and Philadelphia, where rivals are cutting flights. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, worse than expected. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you've got a meeting or a conference you need to be at in China sometime in the next 2 months or so, I hope you've got refundable tickets unless you already have your visa in hand. Beijing has confirmed anecdotal reports that they're tightening up on business visas until after the Olympics are done. A spokesman said today they're not even going to process applications until September 20th. That's not necessarily the attitude you might expect given the economic opportunity that the Olympics present to China. Joshua Ramo is with Kissinger Associates in Beijing. Good to have you on the program.
Pleasure to be with you.
What's at stake for brand China here as the Olympics approach?
Kai, I think probably one of the most important things to keep in mind is that brand China is still in the process of formation. But I think what the Chinese understand is that this is arguably the most important moment that they've had on the world stage in several decades, and it's an opportunity, unique opportunity, to really begin to define what they stand for in the minds of a lot of people around the world.
If things go well, though, what are we going to see? Is it going to be better exports, higher quality, more capital inflows, more deal-making overseas?
This isn't a graduation. It's not like China's going to be different 17 days after the Olympics start. I think what you'll see is a continuation on the path that has already been established here by a nation that is more confident at the end of August maybe than it was at the beginning of August. But I think the overall trends in the Chinese economy at the moment, you know, you mentioned deal making, some of these other things. I think almost everything we're seeing on the ground today suggests, for instance, less of a role for foreign capital, trying to be more discerning about the types of development that go on here to make them more sustainable, more environmentally sustainable. I think a continued effort to bring development away from just the coastal regions into the poorer parts of the country where those 700 million people living on less than $2 a day largely live. And that process is really set in stone. There's nothing that's going to happen with the Olympics, either good or bad, which will have much of an impact on that.
It's been a tough 6 months for the Chinese government in terms of its face projected to the world. You've had the Tibet protests, you've had the Olympic torch, you've had the news that they're basically cleaning out Beijing and the major cities of peasants and undesirables. Are they prepared to deal with the backlash from that when the whole world is watching?
I don't think they're ever prepared. I mean, I think one of the lessons of the last 6 months is the degree to which they're often baffled by that. I think Chinese were flabbergasted by the reaction to the torch around the world. When that sort of stuff happens, it sets off an almost kind of fearful reaction somehow of like the concern that somehow the ideas they've had about the way the rest of the world sees them are inaccurate. And this is the problem of a system that's changing and growing, is that, you know, sometimes you only learn by stumbling your way forward. And I think those stumbles will not be the last. And I suspect you'll probably see some during the course of the games. And I think the key thing to keep in mind is that it's only natural. You can't expect this machine over here, for a variety of reasons, you know, to be running flawlessly, not least when it's confronted with things that it's never seen before.
Do you think Beijing understands the extent of its economic vulnerability based on its external image?
You know, I think I think that is an ongoing debate here. And I think, frankly, they are surprised as anyone by the amount of economic success they've had in the last 10 years. They are surprised by anybody is waking up and finding that they have a trillion eight in foreign currency reserves on hand. You know, this was not stuff that even 5 years ago they could have predicted. And the nature of the system is that it constantly generates things 5 years out that you never thought were possible. To some degree, they have a sense of what's likely to come ahead. But I think they are, you know, their hope is that they can build an economic system that is somewhat resilient to fluctuations in the global market. But they understand that, at least as far as today, is they're very dependent on trade. Global markets are more and more interconnected. And I think they're as exposed to a global economic downturn as almost anybody.
Joshua Ramo is a managing director at Kissinger Associates. We reached him in Beijing. Mr. Ramo, thanks a lot for your time.
A real pleasure, Kai.
More than a year of regulatory squabbling over XM's plans to buy its rival Sirius Satellite Radio is all but done. This afternoon, the Federal Communications Commission is reported to be this close to approving the deal. The two companies had to pay a couple of big government fines and agree to 3 years' worth of price caps first, because the deal means there will only be one satellite radio company. Down here on Earth, cell phones are changing the internet business. Used to be that you could get a DSL connection, that's a phone-based internet hookup, only if you bought residential phone service as well. Somewhere near 32 million Americans only use their cell phones, no landline, but they want to get online too, which has made stripped-down high-speed internet a hot commodity. Katie McPherson reports.
Do you have an urge to get naked?
We're going streaking! Yeah!
Not that kind of naked. I'm talking about high-speed internet that comes through a phone line. If you take just that service and not phone service, you've got naked DSL.
I still can't believe we even use that phrase.
Teresa Mastrangelo is an analyst with market research company Broadband Trends. She says until recently, telephone companies kept naked DSL under wraps.
They didn't want a customer to stop paying for their telephone service and just take the broadband connection.
Analysts say there is a high demand for naked DSL, especially among young college grads who are dumping landlines in favor of cell phone service. A recently released federal survey says nearly one out of every six American homes had only cell phone service in 2007, up significantly from the year before. And that means the demand for naked DSL is growing. But providing just internet scares phone companies, who fear that customers could end up switching more easily to other providers.
As customers turn off their fixed-line telephone and go directly to a mobile telephone, there's obviously a loss of revenue associated with that.
They may not like it, but phone companies are coming up with ways to compromise with their phone-free consumers. AT&T has a sneaky solution. Distract customers from opting for their $20 per month DSL service by advertising an attractive package that includes cell phone service.
Welcome to Getting Together, where you bundle and win.
30% of AT&T's new DSL subscribers in 2008 got naked DSL, and about half of those customers swallowed the bait and took packages with cell phone service. But what about customers who don't want to get cell service from their DSL provider? They could drop as much as $60 a month on just the DSL connection, depending on the company. Research firm TechDirt's CEO Mike Masnick says telcos aren't going to make it very cheap or easy to get just naked DSL.
They're never going to make it appealing in any way, and they're always going to try and hide it and try and make all sorts of other packages a lot more appealing.
So don't expect to see telephone companies letting it all hang out anytime soon. In Washington, I'm Katie McPherson for Marketplace.
Coming up, teachers get their summer break, sort of.
Without teaching, there's nothing for me to do. Well, except for the book manuscript that I'm editing. Oh, and the book manuscript I'm writing. Oh, and the many conference papers I need to write. And the grant proposals I need to prep.
Oh, and the numbers. The Dow Industrials dropped 2.4% today, 283 points to close at 11,349. The Nasdaq tumbled 1.9%, 45 points to finish at 2280. The S&P 500 slid 2.25%, 29 points to end at 1252. Ford skidded 15% on that record quarterly loss we told you about. General Motors sputtered down 11% today. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac both gave back all of the gains they made yesterday and then some. Fannie Mae fell nearly 20%. Freddie Mac dropped 18% today. We told you yesterday that the New York Attorney General was considering legal action against UBS. It happened today. UBS shares slid 7%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.01%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders and new home sales for June. The House Financial Services Committee talks with lenders and consumer advocates about helping people modify their home loans. And it's a day to thank those folks who protect you from viruses, keep you networked, and make sure you get your email. Tomorrow is System Administrator Appreciation Day. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Nearly 100 miles of the busiest waterway in the country have been shut down for the past day and a half. An oil spill has forced the Coast Guard to close the Mississippi River to barge and container traffic from New Orleans all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. We've got Coast Guard spokesman Brendan Brewer on the line. And Mr. Brewer, what's happening down there now?
Well, you've got response workers up and down the river using small boats. And what they're doing is they're putting out boom, which is material that sits on the top of the water and kind of corrals oil in different spots. I arrived in town last night, and when I got close to the river in downtown New Orleans, there was a real strong smell of diesel oil. So we're monitoring that, and it's Louisiana in the summertime, so everyone's having to drink a lot of water, a lot of sweating going on out there, especially with our folks working directly with the oil because they've got to wear a lot of protective equipment to keep themselves safe. So that's one of our biggest concerns this time of the year.
Describe what happened for me, would you?
There was a collision between a 600-foot tanker and a barge in the Mississippi River right on the downtown New Orleans riverfront.
And so the contents of the barge have basically emptied themselves into the river, is that right?
That's right, Kai. The barge was carrying approximately 420,000 gallons of number six fuel oil used as a fuel for ships. And right now our estimate is that about 417,000 of that oil is spilled into the river.
What's happening to all these container ships that need to get back and forth along the river there?
Well, right now, one of our priorities is, of course, reopening the waterway to commercial traffic. We've got a few dozen ships either upriver or downriver or in one of the tributaries of the river waiting to transit. And we've got a team of folks here that their specific job is to come up with a plan on how to start moving that traffic that's backed up.
What's the timeline then for opening this up? I mean, how's the plan going to get this river open again?
Well, we don't have a timeline yet. We're still mapping out where all the oil is, and we've got dozens of vessels on the water and two or three helicopters up in the air as we speak that are still going out and assessing where all the oil is. And, of course, with it being in the Mississippi River, that's going to change because that oil is moving downriver. So once we come up with that map and we've got all of our strategies in place, that's when we'll start to get commerce moving again.
You said you had no timeline. Care to hazard a guess as to when the river might open again?
I've heard a few guesstimates thrown around, but I wouldn't want to put that out right now.
Chief Warrant Officer Brandon Brewer with the United States Coast Guard. We reached him down in Belle Chasse, Louisiana. Thanks a lot for your time.
Okay, no problem.
The politics of high gas prices were on display in Washington today. Democrats and Republicans in the Senate couldn't agree on whether they should even vote on a bill to curb speculation in the oil markets. Over in the House, they couldn't agree on whether to release 70 million barrels of crude from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Gas prices have actually been dropping as oil has been sliding. It's not exactly cheap yet, $4.06 this week, according to the Department of Energy. And gas money still accounts for a painfully high proportion of some people's paychecks, especially in the South, and especially the rural South, like Wilcox County, Alabama. From WBHM, Tanya Ott reports.
The dark, rich soil in Wilcox County made cotton king decades ago. But today, trees are the main commodity, and hulking lumber trucks roar down county roads day and night. There's more space on those roads now because locals are driving a lot less. You can still gas up at about $3.99 a gallon, but that's out of reach for many of the county's 13,000 residents. One in three people here live below the poverty line.
You know, most places that you want to go, like visit your friends or whatever, you can't do it because gas is sky high, you know, especially when you ain't getting paid much.
Betty Woods makes $7 an hour working at a restaurant the regulars call Chickadee. She also works part-time jobs at a grocery store and cleaning houses. Altogether, she brings home about $1,000 a month, but she gets no benefits, no health insurance, and she has plenty of bills to pay.
Trader note be like $370, then them light bill be sky high. Shoot, $200-something of a light bill. And shoot, so you got to do what you got to do.
Making do is just part of life these days for Reginald Southall. He's finishing a lunch of baked chicken, corn, and peach cobbler. A great meal, he says, but it's getting pricey. Like most things around Wilcox County, the cost of food has gone up. Bad news for a county where unemployment stands at nearly 14%, more than double the national rate.
You gotta have gas to go back and forth to your job. You gotta have food to survive. So I think everybody just kind of scaling back on both ends of it.
Southall's lucky. He's got a job as an electrician, but just getting to work takes a huge bite out of his paycheck.
The farthest I drove from here to work in one day, it's like 148 miles one way to work. Commuting sometimes is a wear and tear on your body, but if you want to make better wages than the wages that are offered here, you're going to have to travel to get them.
When the rest of America gets a cold, we go into convulsions here.
John Matthews is a Wilcox County commissioner. He says with few stores in the area and no public transportation, residents have no choice but to drive. And he says there are only a handful of gas stations in Wilcox, so prices are often higher than in neighboring counties. Matthews says high fuel prices are squeezing the county as well.
We're on the verge of having to make some real, real tough decisions here to stay alive here in this county.
Matthews says they may have to put off fixing several condemned bridges and even maintaining the roads. He says they'd like to capitalize on untapped resources, a river and lake that are filled with bass and crappie, but there's no major interstate close by. So tourists have no easy way to get here, even if they could afford the gas. And without an interstate, the county isn't likely to attract any kind of commercial investment, meaning prospects don't look good for Wilcox County, Alabama, or the people living there. I'm Tanya Ott for Marketplace.
You know those people who you know have jobs, but you're not sure exactly what they do? Commentator and university professor Dan Dresner gets that vibe a lot, especially during the summertime. And his number one critic is his little brother, Jay.
Jay Dresner.
Hey, it's your brother. How you doing?
Oh, good. What's up, Dan?
Oh, not much. Mom called the other day.
Oh, is she doing okay?
She's fine. You know, a little worried about the price of brisket, but besides that, okay. She asked if I was teaching this summer.
Oh, jeez. Why is she asking you that?
She does this every summer. You know this. She always asks me, am I teaching? I say no. And I still have to say that I'm doing work.
Sometimes that's difficult to justify with what you do for a living, Dan.
You know perfectly well, my little brother, that I do a fair amount of work over the summer, even if it's not including teaching.
Oh, wait, that's right. You're doing research.
Dude, I can hear the air quotes over the radio. I've been a professor for 11 years. You know how this works.
Oh, wait a second. Explain it to me now how difficult your quote-unquote job is.
Fine, I confess. Without teaching, there's nothing for me to do. Well, except for the book manuscript that I'm editing. Oh, and the book manuscript I'm writing. Oh, and the many conference papers I need to write. And the grant proposals I need to prep. And the multiple journal articles and book manuscripts to review. There's the university committee I need to serve on, the professional committee I need to serve on. I got a lot of work.
When I think about what you do for work, and I'll give you credit for what you do in the classroom, because that's actually teaching students, and that's a service that's demanded for, and they pay for that with their tuition. But what I really don't understand is all those things that you theoretically do, and I do mean, you know, quote-unquote work at, outside of teaching. How many office hours do you hold, Dan, for your students?
Maybe two a week.
2 hours. Okay. And then how many hours do you spend lecturing? Around, what, five, six?
Six.
So we're up to eight now, and that's good for, let's say, one shift at Starbucks. When do you go to the pool? There's got to be time for the pool. My job, when I was in investment banking, I worked 80 hours a week. Now I'm at a hedge fund. I can't just take off a month and decide to come back and see where my portfolio is. It doesn't work that way.
By the way, the sound you're hearing right now is the world's smallest violin playing for you.
Well, Dan, I have to say, I do make more money than you, and I do get our parents better gifts as a result. And you know what? I think they love me more.
That was cold, man.
Dan Dresner is a professor of international politics at Tufts University. His brother Jay works in finance in New York City. We are working on a summer book project. If you're reading anything smart this summer, tell us about it. Could be nonfiction about globalization or a primer on the subprime mess. Go to marketplace.org and then click on the link that says Best Marketplace Beach Reads.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note before we go, I wanted to let you know the Commodities Futures Trading Commission is serious about cracking down on speculation in the oil markets. Today, the CFTC accused a Dutch trading firm and some of its executives of conspiring to manipulate energy futures contracts on the New York Mercantile Exchange about a year and a half ago. Whether or not they did it will be up to a jury to decide, of course. But if they did, well, they weren't very good at it. The CFTC's complaint says the firm Optiver Holding, they're based in Amsterdam, tried to manipulate crude prices 19 times. They were only able to make it work 5 times. Twice prices went up. 3 times, the prices actually went down. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 283 points, 2.4%. The NASDAQ dropped 45 points, 1.9%. The S&P 500 fell 29 points, 2.25% there. Kevin Arnovitz, Stephen Gregory, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, John Haas, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, Canada pays for its troubled past.
They didn't pay any attention to us. They just let us do what we wanted to do. We could go uptown and buy drugs.
What sort of drug?
Acid.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.